B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, September 6, 2019. We are just starting to process the incredible devastation caused by Hurricane Dorian as it stalled over the Bahamas for as long as 36 hours, with incredibly high winds dumping massive amounts of rain, and it will take a long time for Abaco and Grand Bahama to recover. These islands are barely livable at this point, and you can expect tens of thousands of people to leave Abaco and Grand Bahama and become refugees. And just a quick footnote, I feel pained by this at times, but I'm not in a position to cover these massive disasters. I'm just one guy here, and the corporate media, I think, does a decent job of providing the coverage of the storms and their impact. But I have one bit of advice to offer you. If your heart is broken or affected by the scenes that you're viewing, and that is, don't give a dime to the Red Cross. Now, I'm biased, I'm going to admit it, but after the 1989 earthquake here in San Francisco, we saw the opportunism of the Red Cross as they raised money across the nation and around the world for earthquake relief in San Francisco, and then didn't spend it here. My friend Mayor Art Agnos at the time had to shame them into spending part of the money here. But look for direct relief agencies or even funding volunteers who post on Facebook or other social media that they are going to provide direct help to the victims of Hurricane Dorian. So, as this massive storm, which of course is a product of climate change, produces a new generation of refugees in our own region, the Bahamas, just 90 miles off the coast, maybe even less. The Trump administration has a meeting scheduled for Tuesday where they are planning to reduce the number of refugees permitted into the country in the year 2020 from 30,000 this year to zero. And the idea that we're full, we don't have room for anybody else in this country, is pure bullshit. And the cruelty of these policies, which are simply designed to pander to voters to try to get Trump reelected next November. It is so obscene that words fail me. I look for the right term that might fully describe this, and frankly, I can't find it. In other news, as we prepare for another observance of September 11th next week, we continue to fight for the truth about the events of 9/11/01. And our friends at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth have published a timely new report based on an in-depth study by engineers at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And they focus on the implosion of Building 7 at the World Trade Center, the 47-story tower that collapsed into its own footprint, falling more than 100 feet at the rate of gravity for 2.5 seconds of its 7-second destruction. And this new study concludes two things: that the collapse of the tower was not caused by the fires that were observed at different times in the building that day. And listen to this careful engineer's language. The report concludes that the collapse of WTC-7 was caused not by fire, but rather by the near simultaneous failure of every column in the building. And they leave it to us to fill in the blanks there. What could possibly cause the near simultaneous failure of every column in the building? And the answer, of course, is demolition. We'll have more next week on September 11th, and I will be attending and emceeing portions of the annual 9/11 Truth Film Festival at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. So if you're in the Bay Area, I invite you to come by. It's always fascinating. I always learn a lot, and I have deep respect for the people who continue to fight for the truth and trying to eviscerate the cover-up. At a courtroom in Oakland yesterday, the jury came in after struggling over the negligence charges filed against Max Harris and Derek Almena over the tragic fire at the Ghost Ship building. That occurred December 2nd, 2016, killing 36 people. And what's fascinating here is that I believe that there was pandering involved by the prosecutors and by a judge in this case. And I believe the judge looked over his shoulder, looked across the bay to Stanford where the Brock Turner case had played out, and where the judge who ruled on the facts before him and gave what was viewed as a lenient sentence to Brock Turner. That judge was recalled and removed from the bench. And in roughly the same time frame, the judge in Alameda County, James Kramer, tossed out the plea deals that would have sent Almena and Harris to prison. 6 years in county jail for Harris, 9 years for Almena. That's what they had accepted. But the judge threw out the plea deal, told the DA to prosecute the case, and the jury acquitted Max Harris and was hung, unable to reach a verdict for Derek Almena. Now, the prosecutors say they'll try Almena again. And I happen to know the attorney who is the leader of the defense team. That's Tony Serra, the celebrated, some say notorious, defense attorney from here in San Francisco. And while I struggle with this because I do think that Almena and Harris were negligent, and I don't believe that they should be, simply exonerated. At the same time, the city of Oakland, the fire department, the owners of the building, the inspectors, they all failed. And no effort has been brought to hold them accountable, although the civil trial process on behalf of survivors of the victims may address that down the road. Meanwhile, another story centered on San Francisco because Juul, J-U-U-L, is the leading manufacturer of vaping devices, also called electronic cigarettes. Now there are as many as 450 cases with 3 deaths. The 450 cases from 33 states, describing a mysterious severe lung illness that's linked to vaping. And officials at the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, say they think some chemical is involved as the cause, but they haven't identified a single responsible device, product, or substance. In an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, authors said that it's not clear which substances in vaping are causing the damage. E-cigarette fluids alone contain at least 6 groups of potentially toxic compounds. They suggest the mixed-up stew of chemicals might create new toxins. And they just published a study today of 2 large clusters of 53 cases in Wisconsin and Illinois. Median age there, 19, mostly male. 98% of them were hospitalized, half required admission to intensive care, a third of those required ventilation. Now, this is a confusing line, and I'm quoting from the New York Times. The majority vaped a product including THC, that's the active ingredient in marijuana. And then it says, but a majority also used a nicotine-based product. Now, is that the same majority? You can only have one majority in any particular group. So I am confused by that. And I have to say that The city of San Francisco has banned the sale of the candy-flavored tobacco products and they're trying to ban e-cigarettes altogether. And Juul is spending a bunch of money running a ballot measure to try to keep the e-cigarettes legal for adults. And I've never used tobacco products, so I don't have any personal stake here. But I feel for adults who I know who have weaned themselves from cigarettes by vaping. And I don't know if they go for the candy stuff, and, there's a lot I don't know about it. But since we have not banned cigarettes, it seems to me a little illogical that we are banning a device that helps people get off cigarettes. Now, I understand selling them to young people, getting them hooked on powerful nicotine, those are all very negative issues. But I think they can be managed by controls. So, this certainly throws a whole new wrinkle into the arguments, pro and con, vaping. Yesterday, I promised to watch the remainder of the CNN climate change fora, and I have to confess that my DVR failed to record the segment with Julian Castro, but I watched 20 minutes of Beto O'Rourke and 20 minutes of Cory Booker. And I have to say that Beto comes across as a smart guy who cares about these issues. But he didn't really distinguish himself compared to all of the other Democratic candidates. And then there was Cory Booker, who tried to tell us that when it comes to nuclear power, we should trust the science. And he gave a whole innovation pitch about how he wants to see us build a whole new generation of nuclear power plants that will have zero waste and zero carbon. But it's important to note that we haven't dealt with the waste that's been generated to date, that the huge cost overruns of attempts to build nuclear power plants in the United States in the last 10 years make it almost impossible. And that if we have extreme weather events, like we are seeing with Hurricane Dorian, that nuclear power plants are as vulnerable as any other place, only a massive storm could spew nuclear waste or other radioactive materials along with the storm. And that's not even including the preposterous idea that Trump advanced about nuking hurricanes. So I think that's the biggest takeaway from the climate change setup that CNN brought us this week, that Booker and Yang support nuclear power as a way to address climate change, and the rest of the candidates don't. Some are more strong about their position than others. Well, Democratic leaders of two committees of the House, and by the way, I thought Congress was going to come back into session this week, but they snuck in a whole other week of vacation. I think they're coming back on Monday, but don't rely on me for that, okay? So the Democratic chairs of two committees, Oversight and Judiciary, want to investigate two issues. One, the recent bid by Donald Trump to get the G7 to host its next meeting at his Doral Resort in Miami. And Vice President Pence's decision this week to stay at Trump's resort in Doonbeg, Ireland. Now, I don't object to these investigations. But come on, Democrats. Are you going to impeach this son of a bitch or not? I think I know the answer. And it is a failure to honor and uphold their oath of office, in my opinion. Yesterday, we reported on the important court decision from North Carolina, throwing out the congressional maps as hopelessly partisan, ordering new maps to be drawn, hopefully without partisanship, in just the next couple of weeks, and we'll continue to monitor that. But there's a parallel case related to some of the evidence that was unearthed that shows the intention of Republicans when it comes to the partisan drawing of congressional lines. And if you've heard our in-depth interview with David Daley, who wrote the book Rat Fucked about gerrymandering that was published in 2016, you know that this guy Thomas Hoefler, who died last August, and whose daughter discovered, she opened up his computer files, found a bunch of paper files, and there's a trove of documents that show that Hoefler was the lead guru of redistricting for Republicans nationwide. And Kathy Fung, who was the Common Cause leader in California, now the national redistricting director for the group, she says, "We've already seen that these files have been instrumental in exposing lies around the effort to add a citizenship question to the census and around subverting a court's order to redraw gerrymandered lines. The Hoefler files are important because they're the only thing that will allow the American public to know the truth behind the efforts to rig redistricting and elections. They have to be made public." Well, I support you on that, and I hope that is the outcome of the parallel court proceedings. Every day I stop for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Siri Walgren, Paul Karsh, Joe Carson in Tennessee, and Marvin Rasmussen. He's got himself a $5 a month subscription. You can do it too for the cost of a hipster coffee. Or in some parts of the country, 2 or 3 gallons of gas. You could have a monthly subscription and support my work. All you have to do is drop by peterbcollins.com, click on menu, click on become a subscriber. You hit the sign up page, your options are right there. And I invite you to take out a new subscription to help keep this whole machine running. Well, today the machine is releasing a fresh in-depth interview with journalist Dave Lindorf. He's been on the podcast before. He's a guy I respect. And recently, as he wrote in The Nation in August, he has been subjected to curious secondary screening when he tries to travel into the United States. And in two incidents at Heathrow Airport in London, he couldn't get a boarding pass, went to the ticket counter. They gave him a boarding pass with a special red stamp. One of them said ICE. The other one said it had four S's. And in both cases, when he got to the gate, they called his name over the PA, David Lindorf. We need to secure your... Lindorf tells the story with some humor. And then we get to the critical issues, that this is unconstitutional. And what's kind of interesting is that Lindorf and I had been scheduled to record the interview on Wednesday. He had to postpone. And on Wednesday, a federal court issued a ruling declaring that the use of these so-called terrorist watch lists is unconstitutional, particularly as it affects Muslim Americans who are subjected to arbitrary searches, and nobody knows how you get put on a watch list. You get nominated. But who has the power of nomination? You don't know that. And so far, we haven't found the clear path to get people's names released from these terrorist watch lists. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Dave Lindorf.
You know, I've made light of this and joked about it, but it's very, very serious, because when I talked with lawyers for this legal clinic, CLEAR, C-L-E-A-R, run by CUNY Law, they are a place that will help you fight being on the list. And they're doing really yeoman work on it. They've won some class action stuff on behalf of their clients. And they were explaining to me that it's very hard to get off the list because you have to know who put you on. And under the way this system works that they set up under Bush and expanded under Obama, and God knows what they've done under Trump, any federal agency can, and that isn't any federal law enforcement agency, any federal agency can nominate, I love the terms they use, they can nominate you for the no-fly watch list, and then the FBI is supposed to evaluate it, but they put 98% of the names of the nominees on the list. they don't do any, nobody's been questioned about me, because anybody who was questioned about me would tell me. And they so they put you on the list, and then there's no way to get off it unless you know what agency to go to challenge being on it. And the FBI won't tell you. They won't even tell you if you are on it, and they won't tell you who nominated you.
I invite you to listen to the full podcast interview with Dave Lindorf. It's available for my subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. Tune in, iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher. And if you know somebody who's dying to hear that interview and they don't have a subscription, let them know they can get a 24-hour pass for just a dollar. We try to keep that barrier as low as we can here at the Peter B. Collins podcast. Well, last week, Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter and its CEO, was the subject of a hack. And they got into his Twitter account and posted things that were embarrassing. And it required the Twitter techs to go in and take down their boss's account. Well, the New York Times, under the byline of Nathaniel Popper, reveals that the hack that was performed on Dorsey is called a SIM switch, a SIM swap. Criminals have learned how to persuade mobile phone providers to switch a phone number to a new device that's under their control. It is switched from a SIM card, SIM cards for subscriber identity module, in the target's phone to a SIM card in another device. Once the hackers have control of the phone number, they get companies like Twitter and Google to send a temporary login, you know, with that PIN number. And once they have that, they take over control of the phone. And nobody has a clear way of trying to prevent this so far. But that's quite an embarrassment. And I'm still waiting for Jack Dorsey to respond to my tweet demanding that he apply the same community standards to Donald Trump that he does to everybody else. Beto O'Rourke is hopping mad at Twitter because in a series of false tweets, I mean, these even don't even amount to conspiracy theories. They're just lies. Shortly after the Midland-Odessa shooting last Saturday, tweets appeared saying that the shooter was a Democratic socialist and had an O'Rourke for President sticker on his truck. Well, that is flatly false. One of the trucks was a postal van that he hijacked. But get this. Twitter said Thursday it won't remove the posts because they don't violate the company's policies? I mean, at what point do they need to assert control? It is a private service. It's not a First Amendment issue, really. I want fairness and I want transparency. I want standards that are equally enforced. So Trump can lie repeatedly when he tweets. People can lie about Beto and this gunman having a Beto sticker on his truck. And Twitter does nothing. One of Trump's online gladiators, Jacob Wohl, who has spread false information like claiming that there was a woman who was pressing sexual misconduct charges against St. Bob Mueller when he was running the investigation into Trump-Russia. Jacob Wohl was also involved in the promotion of a false sexual assault allegation against Pete Buttigieg, the gay mayor of South Bend, Indiana. And Wohl, age 21, is a former blogger who's contributed to the Gateway Pundit, a right-wing news site, and he has been arrested and charged with selling an unregistered security in Southern California. Another hacker tried to pull a fast one on the IRS website. 23-year-old Andrew Harris, together with his buddy Justin Heemstra, were students at Haverford College outside Philly in 2016. They used a school computer lab to open a fraudulent federal financial aid application for an unnamed Trump family member. The students managed to reset a password and, using Trump's social security number and date of birth, tried to import his federal tax information into the application. Now, on the one hand, this is kind of resourceful. And on the other hand, it is against the law. He pled guilty, but his attorney said this is a Wayne's World scene gone awry. Sentencing set for December for both men. News surfaces complaints from environmentalists who are advocating addressing climate change. They are receiving messages from Google Discover that link to articles promoting climate science denial. For example, Tommaso Boggia, a climate activist, turned on his Google phone, hit the Discover tab, and it led him to a link to a blog post called "Bipartisan Panel of Scientists Confirms Humans Are Not," all caps, "responsible for past 20,000 years of global warming." Now, Google says that these are articles selected by an algorithm based on people's interests. And Discover is used by more than 800 million people a month. Somebody better go and spank those algorithms. One more story about manipulating your information. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, which is where the internet came from, they are launching a 4-year project to unearth fakes, fake news stories, fake photos, fake video, and especially those deep fake videos that are complete concoctions. But come on now. Who's going to trust a government agency to determine what is fake and what deserves to be purged from the internet? And as we've seen, the attempts by the tech companies themselves to do this have led to arbitrary decisions that have silenced many people. Not just Alex Jones. So, I'm a little underwhelmed at this news. But I am whelmed and a little whipped up by an article in yesterday's San Francisco Chronicle, as the newspaper inserted its self-interest in an article that was nominally about concerns about this new gig worker bill that would redefine Uber and Lyft drivers as employees, not independent contractors. But it would affect about 2 million people in many other lines of work. It's called Assembly Bill 5, AB 5. And I think there are legitimate questions about, for example, how it affects freelance writers. They're allowed to submit up to 35 articles to one publication a year without being considered an employee. But the Newspaper Publishers Association is inserting editorial comments into news articles designed to make people feel sorry for them. They're saying that newspapers are a dying business, and we need to be able to continue to exploit the delivery people who get barely minimum wage to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and drop my morning paper on my driveway. And they're trying to look for an exception, an exemption, for the people who are called carriers, the people who deliver the paper. And they threaten providing those carriers with benefits, which could add up to 30% to labor costs, could be prohibitive. Or newspapers, which already operate on razor-thin margins. My fear is that if print revenue drops because fewer eyeballs are reading the ads, the downward spiral the industry has already experienced could cause more newspapers to fail. But get this. The San Francisco Chronicle charges more than $500 a year for home delivery now. That's roughly $10 a week. And if my carrier delivers to 300 homes at $10 a week, how much of that money actually trickles down to the guy or gal who tosses the newspaper from a car onto my driveway? Now, historically, it was young boys on bicycles who were paid a dime or something like that to deliver a newspaper. And the industry just has this built in, and it isn't quite slavery, but it's exploitation of a certain labor force. And they want approval to continue it. Some big surprises for Republicans who supported Trump's phony call for an emergency based on the so-called crisis that requires him to steal money from the Pentagon budget, money that Congress has already appropriated, and divert it to build some wall. And what we're learning is that even Mitch McConnell, Kentucky is losing $62 million in military construction funds diverted to the wall. Tom Tillis, North Carolina, losing $80 million. John Cornyn of Texas, $48 million. Lindsey Graham only got nicked for $11 million. All of those senators are up for re-election next year, and they all voted for Trump's emergency declaration. We're also seeing that funds that were cut in Europe relate to efforts the Obama administration funded to parry what was seen as Russian expansionism after the annexation of Crimea. And while I have mixed feelings about the purpose of those funds, once again, this is a way that the smokescreen of the wall is being used to secretly take money away from projects that Congress has already approved. And down by the border, the residents of the Riverbend Resort and Golf Club, which is hard by the Rio Grande near Brownsville, they're going to see their community divided by Trump's wall. This is one of those cases where it's just so irrational. They can't build the wall right along the river. So it has to move inland a bit, and it's going to strand this senior center with golf courses, swimming pools, and housing behind the wall. And in the past, when they have built barriers that basically cut off Americans from American turf, well, they put gates. But routinely, the keypads to operate those gates don't work. And the American citizens can't get to their American property because America. Finally, today, I want to recommend a long read for your weekend. I have linked to the excerpt from Stephen Kinzer's new book. It's published at The Guardian today. Kinzer is a respected journalist who writes for the Boston Globe. I've tried to interview him many times. He's been very nice about it, but the scheduling never worked out. He's just published a new book about Sidney Gottlieb, who was a dark prince of the CIA. The book is entitled Poisoner-in-Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. And in the excerpt published by The Guardian, it is a detailed account of the case of Frank Olson. He was the subject of H.P. Alberelli's book called A Terrible Mistake. And he's also the subject of the powerful series on Netflix produced by Errol Morris called Wormwood. I recommend both Alberelli's book and the Wormwood series, and I will do my best to secure an interview with Mr. Kinzer. But his account of the death of Frank Olson, the murder of Frank Olson, is riveting and highly accurate. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast today. You're free to share it with absolutely anyone. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.